Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, January the 17th. We will talk this hour with David K. Johnston. He is author of a brand new best-selling book, Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. We'll welcome your thoughts and questions for David K. Johnston at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. And while they say there's no such thing as a free lunch, he says, while that may be true for most of us, we are paying for that free lunch for the very wealthy, that many of today's government policies often reach into our pockets and our wallets to benefit the very rich. We'll talk about some of the cases that he outlines in the book where lobbyists and lawyers representing the most powerful 0.1% of Americans have manipulated our government at the expense of the 99.9% of the rest of us. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times. His last book was Perfectly Legal. It was a New York Times bestseller. His latest book is Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
It's great to have you back. We talked to you last when you had Perfectly Legal on the bestsellers list. And that was about all the tax dodges and tax breaks that the very wealthy could take advantage of. Perfectly Legal. How is this book different than that one?
Well, this book, Perfectly Legal, was about inflow to the government, taxes. And Free Lunch is about both outflow from the government and government rules that cause you to spend money and give money to wealthy Americans or large corporations, even if you don't do business with them.
Give us an example of something maybe that we don't even realize that we're giving money to big businesses, even if we don't shop there.
Well, Tyco, General Electric, Honeywell, and a few other companies get $2 billion a year of free labor. Tyco alone gets $500 million a year of free labor paid for by local taxpayers.
How do they do that?
Well, it's through a very brilliant hidden subsidy. If you have a burglar alarm in your house, you pay about $30 a month to the burglar alarm company.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an enormously profitable business. According to the industry, 77 cents out of every dollar that you pay is profit to them.
That's a lot
on the
of profit.
Operating level. And just phenomenally profitable. Then, if the alarm goes off, the alarm company, all it does is call the police and tell them to come to your home. Well, that's where the expense is, and that's where the subsidy is. The taxpayers send the police to your home. It costs about $50. Now, at first blush, you might say, well, that's perfectly reasonable. Having the police go sounds like a good public service.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you analyze it a little bit. Turns out not quite so. First of all, 80% of homes don't have a burglar alarm. So everybody is paying for a benefit that goes to one in five homeowners. Secondly, in many, many cities across this country, about every eighth call for service is for a false burglar alarm. In many cities of this country, it's the functional equivalent of having every eighth or ninth patrol officer simply responding to false burglar alarms. They virtually never make arrests. In Seattle, there were, I think it was Seattle I tell about in the book, 33,000 alarms they checked out one year. They made four arrests. Because the average burglary takes 5 minutes, and it takes the police a half hour to respond. It turns out the federal government did a study. Having a dog is just as effective in deterring burglars as having an alarm. And the clear implication of that is putting a little sign in your window that says you have an alarm is just as effective as having an alarm.
Yeah,
all that money could be spent pursuing real crimes and providing real service instead of providing a subsidy to these companies. And 100% of the profits from the burglar alarm industry come from this subsidy.
Well, I'm glad I have a dog, number one. But I don't. It's not like the burglar alarm companies somehow went to Congress to get some sort of an agreement that a police would come to someone's house if their burglar alarm went off, though.
No, in this particular case, there are lots and lots of different items like this that I go through in the book. In this particular case, this has simply evolved as a practice. But in the last 25 years, and most of my book is about how America's changed since 1980, during that period of time, the likelihood of your being burglarized has fallen by half, mm-hmm. by half. But the number of burglar alarms is up about sixfold. Because the industry runs these ads on television, you know, that leave you terrified that there are burglars lurking with a Bowie knife in their mouth ready to go after your children.
Yeah.
And it's been very effective, particularly in urban centers.
Yeah. Well, give us another example of how taxpayers, how most of us are subsidizing or paying for the free lunch for the wealthy few.
Well, 1991... there was a train crash, an Amtrak train crash in South Carolina. Now, the Amtrak train was in good condition. The engineer was sober. The train was going below the speed limit. But when it hit something called the Orlon Crossing, the switch gave way. It killed 8 people. 7 of them, the family settled up. They got the tiny amount of money you get if you die in such an accident. But one widow, the widow of a police officer, fought back. For 10 years, she got her case all the way to the United States Supreme Court eventually. She proved that CSX had cut $2.4 billion of safety. They did this all across America. And, you know, your radio in the morning often reports CSX trains crashing, freight trains crashing. Mm-hmm. Well, the judge said that the conduct of CSX was borderline criminal because instead of properly repairing that switch, they had used not a cotter pin but a rusty nail. And for 10 years, the rusty nail held, and then it broke. A jury awarded $50 million of punitive damages. CSX didn't care, because there's a law that says if anybody dies on an Amtrak train, even if it's not Amtrak's fault, the railroad just hands the bill to the taxpayers. So you and I paid for that bill. And why was there a lack of safety? Well, when John Snow, a big advocate of the policies that I wrote about, took over the railroad, he cut and cut and cut safety. He was told not to cut safety. He was warned. There were official reports. He kept cutting safety. Lots of people died because of these safety cuts. And his pay went through the roof. And Mr. Snow eventually left an extraordinarily wealthy man to become the Treasury Secretary of the United States.
The example that surprised me the most, well, maybe not the most, but I didn't know this, that I have heard about tax increment financing or incremental financing that is used as an incentive to get a business to develop in a local community. But I didn't know that this gives the owners of the development the sales tax that they generate.
That's right. You know, the news media writes about all sorts of things these days in the language of the people who benefit from these deals instead of stepping back and using our own independent language. Tax increment financing. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, TIF districts, that's all.
Yeah, and what it means is that the owners of the store, in some cases of an entire shopping mall, when you are forced by law to pay the sales tax at the cash register on your purchases, get to keep that money. And they use it to pay for building the store. And by the way, they often make deals to be exempt from property taxes for years and years. Now, there are two aspects of this to think about. One is, you know, the school district says we don't have enough money anymore to have art or music classes, and the police don't have enough money to do all the things they need to do, and the fire department says we're going to have to close a firehouse. Well, guess what? It's because that revenue isn't coming in to the government that you are forced to pay. I mean, basically, you're forced to pay a tax that goes to benefit, among others, the richest family in America, the Waltons, who own Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a second aspect. What if you own Joy's Department Store?
What about it?
You're across the street. Mm-hmm. You built it up with your own money and your own hard work over the years, and suddenly this national retailer comes in, opens up across the street, and the government is using tax dollars to subsidize them.
Yeah, that would irritate me.
It would not only irritate you, it will run you out of business. And I tell the story of a man named Jim Weeknecht who charged lower prices than the big national competitors and was making a good living in his little store. And then in this little town of 44,000 people, a company called Cabela's that sells fishing gear and hunting rifles, They got a $36 million deal to come to this little tiny town. $8,000 for every man, woman, and child. In fact, more money than the city budget for 10 years. And, of course, with that kind of subsidy, they ran Mr. Weeknecht out of business, even though he charged lower prices.
But, you know, the argument would be that this, whatever, tax break for the big company to build the store across the street from me is needed in that all the jobs that are going to be created. And if we don't have a big box store here, it's just going to, you know, move down to Community X down the road, and they're going to get all the jobs.
Well, think about that argument for just a minute. What it really says is the market doesn't work. I mean, if that's true, then market capitalism doesn't work. And we need to get a whole new economic model. If you can't make it in the marketplace without the government subsidizing you, then market capitalism doesn't work. Now, I'm a big believer in markets. A lot of my book is defending markets against this kind of thing. And by the way, Adam Smith warned us in 1776 when he wrote The Wealth of Nations about exactly this happening and how this kind of subsidy would ruin the benefits of market capitalism. Secondly, this doesn't create jobs. When the big national retailers operate, they are more efficient than the local entrepreneurs. And they generally pay lower wages, and they have more efficient systems. What happens over time is that they concentrate jobs at their location and destroy jobs elsewhere. They don't add new jobs. Does opening up a new Walmart or a Home Depot suddenly cause people to spend more money than they were going to spend on light bulbs and diapers and pieces of lumber? Of course not. If you're going to subsidize something, you don't subsidize retail. That's the end of the economic chain.
We're going to take a short pause and then continue talking with David K. Johnston, who is author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. What do you think about this? Does this bug you or not? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're tuned to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay with us here on the Ideas Net. Coming up after 5, during At Issue, Ben Marins and his guest will review what we now know about the I-35 bridge collapse in Minneapolis last August and how it applies to bridges and highways across the country. That's coming up after 5 o'clock this afternoon. During this hour, we are talking with a guest who says, yes, the rich are getting richer, and in part that's at our expense, or most of our expense. He says that today's government policies and spending and various subsidy programs often dip into our wallets to benefit the wealthy few at the top. We're talking about some examples of these programs or subsidies that help the rich, and we're wondering what you think about them, what questions you have. Maybe you have your own examples. Maybe you think this is perfectly okay. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times, and his new book is called Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Before we go to the phones, David, why did you think it was important to write this book?
Well, I've spent the last 13 years examining our tax system, and when I wrote Perfectly Legal, which showed that the middle class and the upper middle class now subsidize the super wealthy through the tax system. In effect, they're taxed and money is funneled to those people at the top. People kept asking me a question. They kept saying, well, isn't the economy doing really well? And if so, how come I'm not better off? And I said, yeah, that's a good question. Where did the money go? Because America is more than twice as wealthy as it was in 1980 in real terms. And for every dollar the economy put out in 1980 per person, it now puts out about $1.70. Americans should be flush with money. Instead, one out of seven families has filed bankruptcy. Americans, we all know, are in debt up to their eyeballs. We have television ads promoting loans at 99% interest. I remember years ago talking to a loan shark who went to prison for charging 2 points a week. That's only 104% interest. And so I began saying, yeah, where is this money going? And as I started looking at this, I saw all of these hidden programs adopted, many of, not all of them, but many since 1980, where in various ways the government reaches into your pocket and gives money to corporations and wealthy people, or it allows them to reach into your pocket and take money even if you're not doing business with them.
Yeah. Let's take a call or two. Yvonne in Brown Deer joins us first. Hi, Yvonne.
Yes. I'm really enjoying this guest that you're having. I had read some years ago that in the 1880s, corporations fought their tax status and had it changed to that of the average taxpayer instead of as a corporation. Is that where all of this stuff came from?
No. It's not. We did have something very important happen in the 1880s. The United States Supreme Court, in what lawyers call dicta, not the actual decision but the discussion about it, said that a corporation is a person. Now, of course, people are born, live, and die. A corporation is immortal under that ruling, but it has all the rights in court as a person. Up until that time, corporations were given charters for very limited purposes for limited periods of time. And we've never sort of adjusted that for the reality that they're immortal. Imagine if we had a group of human beings who were immortal. Over time, what would happen to them, unless they're fools? They would become enormously wealthy because of the time value of money.
To talk a little bit, David, about the chapter where you talk about President Bush and the Texas Rangers that he benefited through this the tax arrangement for the stadium?
Right. This is one of the great ironies of modern political life, and listeners should know that the sources for this are public records, the White House, and the friends of President Bush. This doesn't come from any of the people who opposed him. President Bush was a oil and gas tax shelter salesman in a business at which he was spectacularly unsuccessful. And then one day, Eddie Chiles, an old oil man in Texas, wanted to sell his money-losing baseball team, the Texas Rangers. Bush got on the phone to a bunch of billionaire investors he knew and said, we could have a really sweet deal here. We can buy this team really cheap. Then we'll get a tax increase so that we can have a new stadium built for by the taxpayers, and then they'll sell us the stadium real cheap. Well, that's what they did. They held the election in Arlington, Texas in January, not a usual time for elections. There was a very small turnout. The sales tax was increased by a half cent, and the total subsidy was $202.5 million. The profit made when the team was sold was about $164 million, which means that 100% of the gain came not from the business acumen and competitive capabilities of the president and his partners, but from the taxpayers. And this President Bush's share of this accounts for, based on his tax returns and his disclosure statements, at least two-thirds of his fortune.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Well, in his case, people voted for it, although you notice they didn't vote at a general election. The president's position has always been this was a win-win for everybody. Well, think about that for a second. Do most people go to baseball games? No. Mm-hmm. Baseball sells a couple million tickets a year in a country with 300 million people, and each team plays 162 games. Only a tiny minority of people go to baseball games. But everybody in Arlington, Texas, you know, some teenage girl who babysat or did some other work and then went to buy herself a sweater or a book or a CD or an iPod, she had to contribute to President Bush's fortune, even if she never went to a baseball game. And these subsidies have been growing and growing and growing. I mean, they didn't exist back in the 60s. And now the entire profits of baseball, basketball, football, and hockey derived from these subsidies that have now reached $2 billion a year. George Steinbrenner, the owner of the Yankees, is getting over $600 million in subsidies. the group of investors who bought the new Washington Nationals baseball team. All the news stories will tell you they paid $450 million for it. In fact, they got the team for free, courtesy of the taxpayers, because the taxpayers are giving them a subsidy worth at least $611 million. In effect, they were paid over $160 million to buy the team. Yeah. That's not capitalism. And by the way, we don't provide these subsidies for the owners of other forms of entertainment. We don't provide that subsidy for movie theaters, restaurants, cabarets, video arcades, bowling alleys. Those owners don't get those kinds of subsidies.
Yeah. I want to thank John in Milwaukee, who emailed just as we were talking about this this example of President Bush investing $500,000 into the Texas Rangers and then got the state of Texas to build a new ballpark that allowed him to sell his interest in the Texas Rangers for $20 million. That's
$17 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks very much to John. And let's go to another caller, Bob in Darlington. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got a comment and see how your guest responds to it. I think Mitt Romney says this all the time. He says that the engine that built the economy and the nation, you know, for the economy was small businesses. And now, like your guest has been telling about small businesses, they're not treated very equally in this wonderful democratic republic of ours. So I think that if we could have a little better treatment of small business, including small farms, you know, and any business of any size, I think should be treated more equitable, more equally.
Yeah. Big businesses get more of a break than small businesses, David?
Yes. And by the way, one of the things in my life is that I own, with one of my grown sons, a tiny little hotel management company. Mm-hmm. We manage one hotel, and we're buying a second. And we don't get any kind of subsidies. If we would be laughed at if we proposed to the city where our little tiny hotel is that we got some kind of a subsidy. And all the government rules and regulations are incredibly onerous and tough. The tax code of the United States is written overwhelmingly to favor multinational companies over purely domestic companies, which is to say it is written against the interests of family-owned businesses. But if you go to the national organizations that supposedly represent small business, they often don't even tell their members about legislation and opportunities that would benefit them because they are deeply in bed with, on a lobbying level, deeply in bed with groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce who have, frankly, very different interests.
Thanks to Bob. Next we go to Steve in Eau Claire. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I'm glad this discussion of capitalism has been brought up, because I, like the like your guests, support capitalism. But even Adam Smith says, when you're playing a football game, you need referees. Well, what these folks have done is they've gotten rid of referees, saying we have too much government, but they keep the few referees that call the game in their favor. But then they call themselves capitalists, and they spend all their time through lobbying and laws to insulate themselves from the rigors of the free market. It's more like corporate socialism. They even pay lower taxes. They say dividends and interest should be taxed less than if you push a shovel for a job. I mean, these people are as immoral as it gets, and they're not capitalists. They pretend they're capitalists, and we've bought hook, line, and sinker, especially for the middle-class business people who vote for the Republican Party. I'd rather have the Democrats tax me a bit more than have the Republicans who raise debt, which later becomes even more of a tax. Thanks.
Reaction, David?
Well, it is without question that what we really have is corporate socialism for the very wealthy and large corporations and market economy for those with less. And people don't understand this because the way the news media covers these things, it often uses the language of the people who are benefiting from this instead of its independent analysis of this. The government has all these different systems that remove risk. You know, Adam Smith told us, seldom do members of the same profession gather, even for merriment, but that the conversation turns to a conspiracy against the public to raise prices. Government, by no way of liberty or justice, can prevent such voluntary meetings, but ought not to do anything to facilitate them. Well, you know, it's been 231 years since he wrote that book. Lots of our economic policies are adopted in the name of Adam Smith's ideas, because he's the father of market capitalism. And yet, Who do you see on the dais when the National Association of Manufacturers and the Farm Bureau and the Chamber of Commerce and the Chemical Industry Association have their annual meetings, but the President of the United States, the Vice President, Senators, Congressmen, Governors, and Cabinet Secretaries, who in fact facilitate those meetings and continually allow this concentration of business so there's less and less competition. We only have four major accounting firms in this country. That's not competition. That's what economists call oligopoly. And what's the difference between oligopoly and monopoly? Well, in oligopoly, there is a scintilla of competition, but that's all there is, a scintilla.
Tell us how the homeowner's title insurance has become a costly, deceitful, yet almost invisible oligopoly.
Well, you know, you buy a home, and I remember when I bought my first house as a young man, I was so thrilled I had been successful enough to do something my parents hadn't done. And you're signing all these papers. They say, sign this, initial that. And when you get done, they give you a statement. And lo and behold, there's always one big item on the statement. Today, it typically runs close to $1,000. It's for title insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's title insurance, and what's it do, and why does it cost so much? Title insurance is to address the issue that somebody might come forward and say, I am owed money on this property, or I have an ownership interest, and to protect you. Well, 90 cents on the dollar. So if you spend $1,000, $900 of that money goes to kickbacks and bribes. They're illegal. They are endemic in the industry. I cite in the book the official reports of the insurance commissioners of Colorado, California, Washington. I tell about a title insurance company in Minneapolis that will not pay these bribes. And I know you'll be shocked to hear, because he won't pay these bribes, that he's small.
Okay.
But or institutional corruption is not something you only find in Latin America and Africa and the Middle East and Asia. We have it right here. And the actual cost of title insurance for the benefit that people get, the payments that are made to settle cases, is so small that the banks could provide it and simply fold it into the cost of making a loan. It certainly does not exceed, including searching the title, $25 per property on average.
We will go now to Patricia in Madison. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning. I don't know if your guests will know the specifics about this, and I'm not that clear on it anyway, but do not the counties surrounding Milwaukee have to pay a tax towards Miller Park when they wanted to build a new stadium? And I can't remember now. Is there not a tax also around Green Bay also for Lambeau Field?
Yeah, there were hikes in the sales tax for the regions, the counties around those stadiums. I don't think it's ongoing. I think it was, though, to help pay for the building of new stadiums and or the renovation of Lambeau Field. That is another example of what you're talking about, David K. Johnson?
Yes, that's the tax increment financing, mm-hmm. and it's going on all over the country. And, you know, if we're going to do that, why are we doing it for baseball stadiums, for example?
Well,
we had a baseball strike in 94, and economists who studied it discovered that during that strike, the businesses at arcades and movie theaters and restaurants and bars flourished because people weren't going to the ballpark. Why are we subsidizing one business against another, particularly in a business where clearly there's a market? You know, in England, they have a free market in commercial sports. In the U.S., all the four big leagues, football, baseball, basketball, and hockey, are exempt from the economic laws of competition. They control where a team is. They will not allow anybody else now to have a municipally owned team. You can't put a team in a city and say, I want to join the league. But in England, you can. So there are 13 commercial soccer teams in the greater London area. Ticket prices are a lot lower, and you have real market competition.
Yeah. Of course, the Packers aren't going anywhere. Go Pack. But the Milwaukee Brewers at the time, I think, were saying, hey, we need a better stadium in order to attract more crowds, to be financially viable. We might have to go to a different city that has more support for the team. So
well,
Milwaukee
doesn't
want to lose the Brewers, and so that's what happens.
Yes, but the only reason that the team can make that threat is that there isn't a free market. If we had a free market, they could leave, and anybody else could start a new team and enter the league. And that's where the trick is. You know, the Attorney General of Ohio, when they were held up like this, has said there's a simple word to explain what these team owners do: blackmail. Mm-hmm.
Let's take another short pause, and then more calls for David K. Johnston. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times. We talked to him once before during his last book, Perfectly Legal. Now he has a new book out. It's called Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill, talking about these various government programs or policies or subsidies that help out the very, very wealthy and big business types that come out of our pockets at taxpayer expense for the most part. 1-800-642-1234 and Madison 263-1890. We welcome your thoughts and questions for him. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn is with you. And according to Kathleen's first guest this morning, the Republican Party is undergoing a process of creative destruction, which will result in an invigorated GOP, according to Kathleen's guest after 9 o'clock. We're talking with David K. Johnston, author of Free Lunch. 1-800-642-1234 and Madison 263-1890. Before we go to the phones, David K. Johnston, what's the fix for all of this? What can we do about this?
Well, we can stop this. A lot of people say to me, you know, well, there's nothing we can do about this. That's, in my view, the most un-American thing you can say, because we started this whole country on the idea that we didn't need King George to tell us how to run our lives. We can take care of ourselves. We've overcome enormous problems in this country. We've ended slavery. Women have the right to vote. We've expanded all sorts of things in our society, and we can stop this. The core of this is campaign finance. A group that I call the political donor class are getting a very outsized voice. And because politicians generally come from safe districts, if you're a D or an R, you're going to get reelected. They really depend on these donors. And so they have to be working for what those donors want. Even if they think the donors can't ever get what they want, they have to be working for that. And that's what they think about all the time, not about you and me. Well, more campaign finance reform is not going to fix things. Tweaking McCain-Feingold will not help. The Supreme Court's very hostile to campaign finance reform. So my proposal is that we reach into the Constitution. We take the franking privilege that's there that allows congressmen to send mail, unlimited amounts of mail, and we as taxpayers apply it and stop trying to get a free lunch by not paying the real costs of Congress. You're in Congress, you have to maintain two households, you have a lot of expenses to travel around. We now have congressmen act as beggars where they get rides in corporate jets. Gee, opportunity to lobby them for something that you and I don't get unless we own a corporate jet. They get golf trips, the famous $250,000 golf trip for Tom DeLay and some of the other leaders, and free meals. And I tell about particularly a fascinating story about these free meals business. And what we need to do, I think, is pay the full cost of Congress, make a record of all of it, put it up on the Internet so that people can analyze whether you're frugal or profligate, and voters can decide what they want to do with the profligates. And in return for paying the true costs of Congress, if you take a cup of coffee from a lobbyist, you go to prison. We will stop 100% this legalized bribery. Now, some critics have said that's kind of naive. It won't stop the problem. Okay, maybe it won't. But we need to start having a serious national discussion about how do we get our Congress and our state legislatures to represent not the moneyed people, but the people.
Yeah, and when you say the full cost of Congress, just hiking the salary of a Congress member by a lot, is that what you mean?
Well, no, but for example, you have to maintain two households. Well, so why don't we allow them to essentially expense the fact that they've got two households? Wherever you're going to fly, if you're going to go speak to the National Association of Manufacturers, don't let them pay for that trip. We'll pay for that trip as the taxpayers. And so if you think it's important enough to go, you're going to have to tell taxpayers you charge this for it. The line in my book is, you know, Senator, who's on the Health Committee, if you really need to inspect the cleanliness of that sink behind the bar in Tahiti, for your official duties, you go right on down there in the jet you chartered, and we'll pay for it, but we're going to tell everybody exactly what you did.
Yeah, and it'll be on the net. I get it. Mike in Langlade County. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Your guest is right, and the situations that he described, you haven't even begun to scratch the surface. And the Walmart spectacle just here in Wisconsin, Walmart has each of its local stores pay a fee to Arkansas, and therefore that severely diminishes their profits, and the state of Wisconsin collects nothing in income taxes from Walmart to speak of. And the fee is simply a paper shift of money. But I can remember back when I was first doing income tax work in the 60s and 70s when we had marginal income tax rates of 70% and some cases 91% on the richest people, which back then weren't nearly as rich as they are today. And fellas I knew were selling railroad rolling stock as investments to people like plastic surgeons that were making $200,000 or $300,000 back then, who by dint of the tax code as it was written with a 10% investment credit and then the ability to write off a railroad car in 5 years, people that could come up, physicians that could come up with $1,000 to invest in a $50,000 railroad car or 8 or 10 or 12 of them could actually wipe out their tax liability entirely.
Right.
And that's where the alternative minimum tax came from. So I just passed that advice on. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you might have scratched that surface a little more in your previous book, right, David?
Yes. Yeah. In Perfectly Legal, I went through all that stuff. And Mike is quite right about the things we've been discussing. I mean, that's why I wrote a whole book about this, to tell people through the stories of individual Americans, some of whom got rich and some of whom were ruined and some of whom were heroes, unsung heroes, who stood up and did the right thing. Because everybody's not a scalawag. Most people want to do the right thing. And we don't tend to write about them in the news media, so that you get a very rounded picture about this side of this, which is the subsidies and the forced flows of money by government policy.
Yeah. Well, and we may not have scratched the surface of all the various examples and stories in Free Lunch about these subsidies or various programs that benefit the wealthy and big business that come out of our pockets. Is there another shocker you want to pass along?
Say it again.
Another shocker or surprise?
Oh, shocker. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I missed that word. Well, let me talk about how our policies have endangered our national defense.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese military and its war colleges is teaching its junior officer corps that war with the United States is inevitable, and that they need to prepare the People's Army for that war. Well, with modern warfare, one of the things we have all seen on TV are smart bombs. Well, smart bombs and the microphone you and I are using right now and many other devices rely on a new kind of lightweight, very powerful magnet made with a rare earth called neodymium. Those magnets were the result of enormous expenditures to develop these powerful magnets. In 1987, companies that appeared to be commercial enterprises started buying the American neodymium companies, the only ones in the world. It turns out, I show in Free Lunch, that in fact those companies were fronts for the Chinese military, and that both the daughters of Deng Xiaoping, at the time the paramount leader of China, who were key operatives in the Chinese military and intelligence operation, were involved in these purchases. And the Clinton administration allowed the Chinese to buy these companies in return for concessions. General Motors was allowed to build trucks in China in return for selling its company in Indiana that made these magnets. But they put a condition on it. The Chinese were told they could not remove this technology from the United States. Why? Well, because we could never engage in an extended war without this technology in the modern world. Hope we don't have a war, but if we get in one, we cannot engage in one without it. Well, the Bush administration came in. The Chinese military, through its fronts, closed every single factory in the U.S., removed the technology, removed all the paperwork, took everything out of our country to China. Senator Evan Bayh of Indiana wrote to the White House and said, what is going on here?
Mm-hmm.
How can this possibly improve our national security? And certainly that's an issue on which President Bush is considered to be very tough, right?
Mm-hmm.
The White House never answered his questions. They will not return my phone calls about it. All they have done is issue a blanket statement saying, rest assured, you're safe.
Well, let's ponder that as we go to Chris in Green Bay. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Joy. What a pleasure to listen to your guest. A terrific, terrific show today. And
thanks.
I just wanted to make a comment. I'm a conservative myself and feel tremendously betrayed by the Republican Party that all the efforts that either one of the parties ever make to supposedly support small business are always hijacked by big business. And that really we need to quit kidding ourselves that if we want to help small business, the way to do it is to get government out of helping any business at all. Small business will compete fine as long as big business doesn't get unfair advantages. That's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you for calling. David K. Johnston?
Well, I think that's essentially the crucial point here is that we want to have a level playing field. And if you build a better mousetrap, provide a better service, run your company more efficiently, and get rich, well, that's terrific. That is absolutely terrific. But it's really hard to compete when the government is putting its thumb on the scale or when the government passes laws that handcuff Adam Smith's invisible hand of the market.
I'm going to share an email from Luke in, I'm not sure where. I grew up in a small Alabama town called Hoover, a suburb of Birmingham. For decades, Hoover had the best schools, police, library, roads. This was because of the Hoover Galleria, the largest shopping center in the state, which provided Hoover with lots of sales tax. But a few years ago, Walmart demanded that they be permitted to build a shopping center next to the Galleria. They demanded the land for free. They demanded roads be built for them. They demanded TIF financing. The city agreed. The Galleria is now in tatters. My sister is still going to school in Hoover, but complains that even basic services cannot be provided for her school. You've heard that story before, David.
Oh, yes, and this is going on all over America. Walmart gets these deals for almost every one of its distribution centers, and they say they seek them for a third of their stores. We don't know how many they have because many of these deals are done through, well, technically public record. They're done through government agencies no reporter covers, and unless somebody does an investigation and goes and looks, no one ever hears about this. And they often create these special tax districts, or should I say, no tax districts for the business.
Mm-hmm.
Warren Buffett had one created just for him last year so that he could receive a $100 million gift for his Geico insurance company. And there is no free lunch here, folks. If you allow these businesses to keep the taxes you're required to pay, then your schools aren't going to have the money and your police and your libraries. And here's the question to ask yourself. How many hours are you willing to work each year in order to make the Walton family, the wealthiest family in America, more wealthy by paying taxes that they get to keep? How many hours are you willing to work each year so that Donald Trump and George Steinbrenner and Tyco and General Electric have more money even if you don't do business with them? And frankly, I'm not willing to work 1 hour for that.
Let's go to Sandy in Amberg, see how many hours Sandy wants to work for that.
None. My question is, I mean, I really, really appreciate this show, but it also frustrates me to no end. What can we as taxpayers do? You know, I mean, I feel like I have no voice.
Well, Sandy, you have a voice. The first thing to do is go read Free Lunch. I wrote this book. That's my role in the world. I'm a journalist. I do investigative reporting. I've been doing it for 40 years. I tell you what you need to know so that you can then learn about things. And if you read the book, one thing will happen is every news story that you read or hear on the air will suddenly take on a new meaning because you'll have a lens through which to interpret the language of the news. Okay? Then you have to start questioning your legislators. Both my books, these two books, and there are two in what I hope to be a series of them, end with the same sentence. Reform begins with you. You can't expect other people to do it for you. And so many Americans have been turned off by politics, partly because the news media, we've really turned a lot of people off to it.
Mm-hmm.
partly because of the scandals, especially back at Watergate, that a lot of people go, ugh, politics, I really don't want to get involved in that. Well, if you don't get involved in it, the people who stay involved in it are going to shape the government to their liking. You know, slaves didn't have any vote. In most places, it was illegal for them to know how to read and write, and yet we ended slavery. Women didn't have the vote, but Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and a lot of men eventually got men to vote that women had the vote. We can fix any problem we have. That's the whole theory of the Constitution. And the minute we give up the idea and we say we're powerless, we are giving up democracy, and we are hastening the day when children will sit down and pick up a high school text that says, the United States of America was.
Thank you very much, Sandy. Stephen Appleton, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have to say this whole conversation just strengthens my belief that we need to throw out the present tax system and go to consumption and sales tax, no exemptions, no credits, everything fair, free, and open.
Does that help anything, David Kay?
Well, under the Constitution, we can have any kind of tax system that we have. One of the jokes I always tell is that if you want to shift the burden of taxes from older Americans who disproportionately pay it to younger Americans, although there might be some problems with enforcement and privacy, we could tax sex under our Constitution.
Did you say tax sex?
Yes, right.
Okay.
And we can have a consumption tax. The Europeans use them. They're very efficient as long as they're self-reinforcing. Regulation, I generally don't like regulation, and I write about regulations that are self-reinforcing, that produce good behavior. Something called a VAT tax, where each step of the process of the service or the business manufacturing passes the obligation along because they've paid it and they have to recover it, is self-reinforcing. A lot of people want to have a national retail sales tax. I think they need to think that through. There will be a much bigger law enforcement component than we have now to enforce that tax, or else we'll have huge black markets. People will slip into buildings not to buy drugs, but to buy mink coats and any kind of luxury goods. And instead of saying, yeah, look at the brand new car we just bought, they're going to say, yeah, you know, my Chevy here, I got 860,000 miles on it, because they want to avoid the tax. And you will have to have receipts to prove you paid for things, or the government will solve this problem entirely by saying there's no more cash. Every transaction will be electronic. We will have a record of it. Now, think about that for a minute. It means the government will have a record of everything you do, everywhere you go, when and where you work.
Ooh, that sounds like a subject for another book yet.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're out of time. You fired a lot of people up. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
David K. Johnston, author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. David K. Johnston is a investigative reporter, a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for the New York Times. His last book was Perfectly Legal. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing this hour. Thanks to Leo Duran for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned, and I hope you join us tomorrow during this hour for our Friday Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.